This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Businesses now have a new way to fundraise for charity through digital advertising. Good Impressions is a software company that lets businesses tell people about the causes they support. The money generated then goes to charity. Ryan Tashima McCormick is a graduate of the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He co-founded the company in New York, but felt Hawaii was the ideal place to launch the business. American Savings Bank was its first client. Tashima McCormick spoke with producer Jason Ubai. He explains how Good Impressions works.
It's a software business and a giving platform that makes it very simple for marketers to use their existing digital ads to show the people that are seeing the ads what causes they support and to raise additional funds for nonprofits. And so the reason why we felt like this was important to build was that, having worked in digital marketing and advertising technology, much of the focus is on driving results for the marketers. And the people that are seeing the ads are almost an afterthought. There's research that shows that right now people just don't like ads, online ads specifically. I think 90% of people recently polled find digital advertising annoying. And at the same time, there's this opportunity for brands to connect on a much deeper level with people that are seeing the ads. People value the company values. And that starts with understanding if these companies really care about their customers. People have to work really hard to earn a living, and they choose what products they're going to buy. And you know, our belief is that they will value and support brands that show that they care about them by giving back to them directly in their communities. And so we wanted to build this platform that made that possible.
I know most people, like you're saying, people are annoyed and they try to avoid digital advertising, or, you know, maybe their eyes pass over it. How does Good Impressions, how will this make a difference where people are like, oh, I want to look at this now, or I need to, this is something that will engage me?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're still early in starting out, but the goal is that if we can differentiate regular ads from these Good Impression ads, which we try right now by putting a yellow border around the ads and a halo that will be either in the top left or top right corner, that they'll see there's a couple polls for the person looking at the ads. One is to understand, curious what this halo is, and if they actually understand that this is an ad that's giving back to the communities, we're hoping that they're curious as to what beneficiaries that the marketer is sponsoring. So what organizations and nonprofits, and what are the values associated with this brand? It's also, and this is kind of a call to action for people seeing the ads, we want the people that are seeing these ads to engage with the ads, because that is a signal that the marketers are listening to understand if they should be giving back more to the communities versus just saying, no, we're good. We've covered our philanthropic efforts. We have business results that we need to look after. That's our priority. But if people are starting to recognize these ads and paying attention to the ads, and we're tracking all of this, then the marketers are going to associate giving back as good for business, and they'll give back more to their communities versus pocketing that additional revenue and keeping it versus giving it back.
The advertisers can choose which causes they'd like to donate to, I mean, through their ads?
Yeah, so currently, just to make this as easy as possible for marketers to participate, we know that many marketers give back to various nonprofits, and I think Hawaii is a good example of a place where there's lots of local businesses. Like our initial launch partner is American Savings Bank. They have a whole program that of nonprofit partners that they've selected along with their employees that they want to support. And so they're already invested in these partnerships. And what they're lacking, though, is any kind of sustained awareness for the everyday person who is, you know, very unlikely to to know about this if they're not working at ASB or haven't seen some initial press. So typically, there's some initial PR push around some charitable effort and partnership, but there's no sustained awareness. And these are the same marketers that are spending a lot of money on their digital advertising efforts. And so they're paying for real estate and they're bidding for your attention as a person. And so what we wanted to do is say, look, you are in front of people. You're paying to get in front of people and you're also giving back. So how do we bring that together? And it's a very simple piece of technology that we've built that's scalable, or they can easily add this onto any of their digital ads that they're buying.
You said it's scalable, but I think I'm interested that you live in New York and the company is based there, but your first client was American Savings Bank. They're a Hawaii-based company. Why did you start with them, and what compelled you to start to have them as your first client?
Well, Hawaii is, just from my experience in both New York and in Hawaii working, it's a much more community-oriented place. I think there's also a much more meaningful impact of having a brand supporting local nonprofits. There are situations that could happen if we were working with a national company on the mainland that wants to support a nonprofit, let's say in Florida, and if the user is seeing an ad in California, it just might not be as impactful. Whereas in Hawaii, these are local nonprofits, and this is ASB is a, you know, is a local bank servicing their community. And so there just seemed to be a very strong fit behind businesses that serve a local community are invested in taking care of their people. And the marketers out here seem to understand that a lot more, where it's a much tougher sell on the mainland to convince someone who is typically more focused on short-term business results to justify putting aside budgets that could be spent to buy more ads to giving back to the community. Hawaii is just it's the perfect launch environment for the company. And so we're optimistic that Hawaii can be the example to show other companies all over the world what this can mean for their brand.
How much money do you hope to raise maybe over the next year for charities through Good Impressions?
It's going to depend on how much adoption we get from marketers. But for some perspective, an initial test campaign that we did with American Savings Bank raised $4,000. And that's not nothing. And we're really proud of that. I think we would be happy. And our ultimate goal is how much impact we make is signaled by how much money we can raise for nonprofits. So we'd love to see in the next, I'd say 18 months, $500,000 to $1 million raised. Wow. That would be satisfactory based on the amount of work that everyone's put into building this platform. I think that it's people that don't work in the advertising industry may not realize how much power they have. People today feel like they're forced to see ads, and they may underestimate how much attention and the resources that these companies have to listen to feedback. So I'd like to compare it to restaurants and Yelp. There was this turning point when Yelp came out where all these individuals started, writing reviews, the ratings, the comments, and that directly impacted those small businesses' success. And so they started to cater to their customers, and they wanted to make sure that they, were servicing them well. I think the same is true with your more typical everyday consumer packaged good product, where you have an opportunity now through social media channels with Good Impressions, our ad platform, to signal that you're interested, that you care about these values. And if they start to see that momentum, I think we'll start to, the whole advertising value exchange will shift towards ads not just pushing their message on you, but saying, give me a reason, let's give the people a reason to pay attention to these ads. A trend, could be, a lottery system where you get free stuff through ads. That would be great. Maybe that's, you'd start to pay attention to ads versus wanting to X out of the ads and install an ad blocker. So we're starting to see that. Examples would be with user data. There are companies that are saying, hey, if you give us some information about you, similar to a research panel, we'll pay you. So starting to see that really early stages. But that was also, an inspiration in starting the business, is that really it was just trying to give value back to the people that are seeing all these ads.
That was Ryan Tashima McCormick, co-founder of Good Impressions, which allows businesses to donate to charitable causes through digital advertising. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard, we're looking at the history of a favorite baked treat. Hilo is the birthplace of many local food traditions, none more famous perhaps than the Loco Moco, but a close runner-up could very well be King's Hawaiian Sweet Bread. In the 1950s, a new Big Island bakery was opened with the sole focus of making delicious, round, soft loaves of sweet bread. It quickly became an overnight island favorite. In 1963, the shop expanded and moved to King Street in Honolulu, where it was renamed King's Bakery. It, too, was an instant success. Freshly baked goods were marketed as being made with the key ingredient, the Aloha Spirit. By 1977, King's Bakery was so popular that locals were shipping King's Sweetbread to friends and family on the mainland. As a result, the company capitalized on the growing demand and built a massive 24,000-square-foot bakery in Torrance, California. Now, during this time, they were rebranded as King's Hawaiian Bakery. For our quiz today, can you tell us what the original bakery was called? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you think you know the answer, the first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the realtors and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
Fresh Air is ending the decade with a holiday week series of staff pick interviews from the decade. On our next edition, we'll hear from two beloved journalists whom we lost this decade, Anthony Bourdain and David Carr. Bourdain was a food writer, a chef, and the host of several food TV shows. Carr was a respected and very readable media columnist for the New York Times. Join us.
Starting this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Hawaii Baptist Academy marked a major milestone with its 2019-2020 academic year. The school nestled in Nu'uanu Valley turned 70 years old. We sat down with one of the first graduates of the class of 1954, Kyo Itokazu was the valedictorian out of a class of three. He went to get his theological degree at Baylor University, where he developed a love for country music and a sweet tooth for southern desserts. Reverend Itokazu became a chaplain in the military as well as at Kuwakini. He is 84 years young. He sat down with us last week to reflect on his time at HBA.
Well, it was the first graduating class in 1954. Yeah, so I started there in 1950, and that was the second year of the HBA school, because it started in 49. And so we were the vanguards. There were no grades above us from ninth grade on to 12th grade. So when I went there, we started with about 16 students. And each year from 10th, 9th grade, then 10th year, we reduced to about a dozen, yeah. And then 11th grade, it reduced to 6. And I was wondering if anybody going to show up for the senior class. And that's only 3 guys showed up, including me. And afterwards, when HBA became well known, I asked the students that used to attend, why did you leave HBA? And they went to other schools to graduate. They said because we didn't want to graduate from an unknown school. It was a brand new school. But whenever people ask, what school do you go to? I said, well, I went to Baptist Academy. And they would tell me, you mean Hawaiian Mission Academy? I said, no, this is Hawaii Baptist Academy. And I said, where is it? Only location, the only way we can give them direction was, well, it's just below Roosevelt High School, you know, where Mark Smith is today, the condos. That was a campus. And it was just a barracks, you know, Army War Barracks building.
I guess when you reflect back, you know, because, you know, now the school has grown tremendously.
Yes.
And people know HBA.
Well, that's true. I left in 54. The sad thing is 2 of my fellow students, classmates, passed away already. So I'm the only one. People always said, you mean only 3 people graduated? You know, I said, well, at least whenever we had a class reunion, we had 100%. You know? And then we would say, well, one of us was in the upper third and the other one.
Well, I guess as you reflect, I mean, you went on to a career in the military as a chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess reflecting back on the grounding that HBA gave you as part of that very first graduating class.
Yeah, I had mentioned before that when I was at Kaimuki Intermediate and I went to HBA, I had to do a catch-up. I was 1 year behind. And so it was a heavy load trying to catch up with all those, carrying those books, like the way we used to in years back. And today everything is iPad, you know?
Yeah, it's all digital.
All digital, yeah. But that's where I learned English. I mean, the correct English instead of pidgin, yeah. And that's where I learned to study, and then I learned to love to study. That's what guided me. And it was just our perseverance. It was difficult on the family finance. So we had a scholarship. The tuition for one semester was $50. And then half the scholarship, we worked, you know, cleaning the latrines, and sweeping the chapel, you know, things like that we had.
Yeah, work study.
Work study. So I don't know, after I left, and my 3 sisters, you know, graduated from HBA. You know, I don't know how my parents manage that, but they managed, you know.
And what did your parents do?
My dad worked for the Pioneer Mill in Cavite in Lahaina. Yeah, and then after the war, we moved over here. Yeah, and then when we came here, my dad worked for the dairy, and then later on became a gardener. And my mom just did housework.
You mentioned that tuition was hard for your family. $50 a semester, people think, oh gosh. You know, today it's thousands of dollars a year, and it is still a struggle for a lot of families.
It is, yeah. But we worked, you know, at the cannery, and that's how we paid our tuition, you know, the summer camp, summer work at the pineapple cannery. I think we all worked at the pineapple cannery. That was a big help, you know, with the finances. Going back to HBA, in the back of the building was a concert hut, and then it was divided in half. That's where the bathrooms were. It was real old-fashioned, the old typewriters. Our teacher used to teach us typing with the music, and everybody would type according to the rhythm, and then boom, 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 type, type, and then everybody returned the carriage at the same time.
Oh, that sounds delightful.
Yeah.
Do you remember what songs you typed to?
Well, some was the classical, like pomp and circumstances, you know, things like that.
That's kind of a nice little memory for you.
Yeah, because we never did have an electric typewriter. And then, you know, putting all those carbon papers and was very difficult, yeah. It's amazing now, but one thing we didn't have was a sports activity because it was a small school. And so only thing we used to do was kick football. But even after school, I stopped by on my way home, got off the bus at Kamiki 10th Avenue. It used to be Piggly Wiggly store.
Yeah, up there on Wailai, right? 10th and Wailai.
Yeah, 10th and Wailai. Just to earn extra money, you know, to pay for the tuition. At least, you know, we weren't in debt. They gave me a scholarship to attend Baylor University, you know, full scholarship. So that helped.
And so what did you study there?
Basically, religion. It's a Southern Baptist school and minored in English speech and psychology. I had a difficult time with speech because of my Pidgin accent. And then I had a hard time understanding the Southern drawl, you know. It seems like they spoke with their mouth closed, you know, because I couldn't understand the way they talked. When I first became a Christian, I never heard of Baptists before. I've heard of Catholics, you know, LDS, Episcopal Church, very active here, even had a Seventh-day Adventist. But I never heard of Baptists. I thought it was a new religion. And when I went to Texas, I couldn't believe. Seemed like every other block had a Baptist church. And so that was quite an eye-opener for me. And then I had to work, you know, for my incidentals, you know. So I worked in a mess hall, in a girl's dormitory, dining as a busboy. That covered my three meals. And first time I ever tasted chicken fried steak, strawberry shortcake, fresh peach cobbler. I never had those before. And I love those desserts. So it was a good eye-opener. It's quite an education. When I first there, my dad was the only son, so we didn't have any Itokazus relatives. And when I went to Baylor University, there were two brothers, Itokazus from Kauai. I was so surprised that I would go to Texas to meet another Itokazu. Yeah.
No relations?
No relations. No relations, yeah. And then occasionally we get together. At least you got to have some rice to eat, you know, local food, yeah. It was a good experience. I spent 8 years in Texas after college. Then I went to Fort Worth, Texas for my theological degree. And then I came home.
How long were you a chaplain in the Army?
I was 20 years active duty. So I got called to Vietnam. I served in the Mekong Delta. It was a scary experience for me. And one thing I learned as a minister, you know, when you're fresh out of the seminary, oh, it's so easy to speak, you know, from your training, intellect, and said, oh, whenever we die, we just go to heaven, you know. But then when I went to Vietnam and encountered my own death, I was scared. And it was at that time I had to completely give my life to God. And that was my encounter with death, you know. And since that time, I learned that instead of from intellect to the people, it's from the intellect processed through my heart and then out, you know, to the people. Yeah, so that was one experience that I learned.
That was Reverend Kyo Itokazu, proud graduate of Hawaii Baptist Academy and valedictorian of the class of 1954. HBA heads into 2020 with an enrollment of more than 1,000 students from kindergarten to 12th grade. The school was started by Southern Baptist missionaries 70 years ago. It was back in 1949. It now offers a college prep curriculum.
It's the end of year, and like other nonprofits, HPR is asking for donations. So why choose our station? With public radio, you know your money makes a difference. When you make a contribution, you help reporters dig into stories that need to be told, bringing you journalism with context and different perspectives. In this end of year campaign, the choice to support HPR is a smart one. Give online, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Our online news partners, Honolulu Civil Beat, have our reality check today. Reporter Claire Caulfield has a story about agroforestry. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so agroforestry, is that what just trees for food?
Yeah, so it's just kind of an academic term for what Pacific Islanders have been doing for centuries and centuries, growing medicine and edible foods, plants in really densely packed areas.
So you were at a conference or a workshop that talked about this?
Yeah, it was a two-day workshop in Waimanalo, and there were dozens of people, mainly farmers from places like Fiji and Hawaii Island, who came to learn how to plant their own food forest or agroforest.
So is there a trick to this that's different from what, you know, Pacific Islanders have been doing for so long?
Yeah, so this is more just, I mean, Pacific Islanders centuries ago had the benefit of having really, really lush forests. They didn't have to start from scratch. But a lot of farmers now have to start from a bare plot of dirt. They don't have decades for this huge forest to grow. So this workshop was about the science of how to kickstart that process. And yeah, you need to plant ground cover so you're not pulling up weeds. You need to, you know, layer the forest, some really tall trees, some medium crops, some fast growing crops as well, so you can recoup your initial investment, because a coconut tree is really expensive. So there's a lot of like real hands-on, real world tips for these farmers at the workshop.
So it's really kind of how to have an orchard of trees, I guess, but be more efficient about it.
Exactly. Yeah, well, efficient in the sense that per, you know, square foot of soil, you have 5 or 6 or maybe 7 different crops growing in that area, where traditional monocrop agriculture, you'd only have one.
And so tell us about this workshop. Where did it take place? And were you out there, you know, getting your hands dirty?
I was. Yeah, I got a nice sunburn from it. It was out in Waimanalo. It was a day and a half. And yeah, everyone, the first day was just learning a lot of hands-on tips from how to make your agroforest economically viable, kind of the history of it. And the second day, we went and planted an actual agroforest. And so, yeah, we were pickaxes and digging trenches, whole nine yards.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we're hearing a lot about how we need to plant more trees to help with carbon offset, you know, just to, mm-hmm. to be greener all around because we're losing our tree canopy.
Yeah, so that was actually some of the reasons that people were there, maybe not farmers, concerned community members, some students. Some were there because they wanted to plant more trees in their own backyard and they wanted to offset climate change or help combat climate change. Some people were there for, you know, political sovereignty reasons or food security concerns. They say, you know, if we had our own trees, we had our own food supply here, we wouldn't rely so much on food from the mainland. And then some were there for economic reasons, wanting to make more money from their plots of land or their backyards.
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, we're hearing so much about trees, and I know there's that one community, I think in Ho'ula, that has planted a lot of ulu trees, breadfruit trees, just to protect mm-hmm. their community and make them more resilient.
Exactly. Yeah, there were people like that who just wanted to grow food in their backyard or from on the Big Island. If another hurricane comes or a typhoon comes, they say we want to be able to feed our families.
So is there an efficient way of harvesting trees that they talked about?
So that is kind of one of the detriments of agroforestry is it's not as efficient in the sense of monocrop agriculture. You can't go bring a combine harvester through a forest and get all of your stuff picked really easily. So it is pretty heavy on the human labor needed to scale up an agroforestry to feed entire communities.
So it's interesting. So you're kind of meshing the old and the new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of really new technologies. We know a lot science back up on how to bring these plots of land up to a really dense agroforestry than we used to. But, you know, it's melding traditional practices with some of this new tech to scale it up for sure.
So what happens now? You have this workshop, you get these farmers excited, and then what?
Yeah. Oh, a ton of them are planting their own agroforestry. I talked to some farmers from the Big Island who were going back in that very next day. They started, you know, redesigning their new forest, redesigning their land to more densely plant crops. And then even some retirees who are converting their little vegetable plots in their backyards to produce much more food.
Yeah, and I know on your website you've got a number of interviews so people can click on those links and actually, you know, listen to the podcast, right?
They can, yeah. This is for a podcast that I host called Are We Doomed, where I answer people's questions about the environment. So this episode was about food security and sustainable agriculture.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Claire.
Thanks so much, Catherine. Have a good one.
All right. That was reporter Claire Caulfield with today's Reality Check. Go to civilbeat.org to read more about it. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer. We spotlight the launch of a new space telescope designed to take aim at what astronomers call exoplanets.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, and also a rundown of things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, fortunate to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal. We've got him on the line right now. Hey, Chris, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. This week's Stargazers, look out for the planet Saturn, which will be visible in the west during sunset and will set shortly after the sun. The moon this week is a mere waxing crescent, meaning that conditions for stargazing will be perfect right into next week.
This week, you have news on a launch of a new space telescope?
Indeed. The festive period has seen the launch of the CHEOPS space telescope, which is on a mission to study exoplanets, those mysterious worlds around other stars. CHEOPS will study star systems that are already known to host planetary systems. Its sensitive optics will be able to observe planets as they orbit the star and make precise measurements that will enable us to determine the physical characteristics of these alien worlds, including, in some cases, how their atmospheres are structured.
And whose project is this?
So CHEOPS is launched by the European Space Agency, but the data will be made available to astronomers all over the world.
And this thing's not actually hunting for new planets. Explain why that is.
Well, once upon a time, finding an alien planet was a big deal. However, nowadays, they are a dime a dozen. In fact, we discover these worlds at such a pace it's hard to keep up with them. Also, we need quality over quantity when it comes to exoplanet data.
So you're saying rather than expanding the catalog of all kinds of different worlds we know a little about, we need to know more about the few that we're studying.
Exactly. Right now, we can determine basic characteristics about these exoplanets, such as their size and mass, but even these quantities are roughly known with a huge margin of error. CHEOPS aims to fix that.
So CHEOPS may actually be able to detect moons.
Yes, this is a very exciting aspect to the mission because the instruments on CHEOPS are super sensitive and may be able to detect if some of these planets, especially the large ones, have moons, such as planets in our own solar system.
And so how long is it going to last and when do you think we're going to get some exciting news?
Well, the news should be coming in shortly, probably within a month or so. And the mission itself is slated for a 3.5-year run. But I wouldn't be surprised if it goes way beyond that.
Yeah, well, based on some of these other ones like the Hubble.
Absolutely.
It is Christopher Phillips and another exciting Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Earlier in the show, we delved into the history of Hawaiian sweetbread. A popular baked treat had its origins on the Big Island. After a few years of extreme popularity, the shop relocated to Honolulu, where it continued its historic success. 14 years after the move to Honolulu, King's Hawaiian sweetbread was so popular, locals and tourists alike were sending and bringing the bread to the mainland for family and friends to enjoy. This customer network gave the company the motivation it needed to build a factory in Torrance, California. As popularity grew in Torrance, a storefront was built for the factory, but it still wasn't producing enough to meet the demand. In the 1990s, a second 40,000-square-foot bakery was built. And to think it all began as a small and local Robert's Bakery in Hilo, started by native son Robert Tyra. And our winner today was Matt Gisa of Waikiki. Congratulations to you. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Native Hawaiians were some of the first fish farmers in history. 800 years ago, they built large fish ponds where they'd raise fish for the whole community. And nature provided, too. Naturally forming fish ponds dotted the coast of the Big Island of Hawaii. On today's Voices of Science episode, host Brittany Connell takes us to Kaloko Honokahau, where efforts are underway to restore traditional fish ponds.
People would build a wall around a lagoon or inlet where there were springs. This created a nutrient-rich pond with a mix of both fresh and salt water. Fish love it. There'd be a small opening in the wall, a kind of gate, really, where small fish could enter the pond. The fish pond keepers would cultivate algae for the fish to eat, so the fish would grow and get too big to swim out of the gate. Perfect, right? Fully stocked fish pond. This went on for hundreds of years. After Western contact in the late 1700s, aspects of Native Hawaiian culture declined. With time and neglect, the fish ponds deteriorated. But there's a movement to reclaim traditional culture and reestablish fully functioning fish ponds that preserve both nature and culture, and serve the people of the community by producing food. At Kaloko Honokahau National Historical Park, there are two fish ponds where these restoration efforts are underway. We'll start at the Aimakapa Fish Pond.
And as you guys can feel this cone of heat, you're kind of lucky we get a little breeze today. This is not the norm. It's usually pretty stagnant air here at Aimakapa, and it's just hot. It's really hot.
Jackson Letchworth is a biologist at Kolokohonokau National Historical Park. He is the lead for the Imakapaw Fish Pond Restoration Project. The Imakapaw Fish Pond is actually a naturally formed pond. There's a long sandy berm that separates it from the sea, and it's connected to both freshwater springs and the ocean underground. Over the years, the fish pond has been totally choked out by invasive plants. The natural food sources for the fish and birds that once thrived here are gone, so Jackson and his team are working to remove those plants. Beads of sweat are cutting little channels through the sunscreen on his nose.
More or less, it's all done manually. So a lot of the work is done in full waders, which don't breathe very well. In full waders, out there in the pond, in the mud, using shovels and saws to remove these clumps of paspalum grass.
Each clump of paspalum grass they remove weighs about 50 pounds. Crew members have to lift and haul each one of these three or four times before it's all said and done.
It's really backbreaking work, and anybody that can do it for several months should definitely be applauded. And we had a pretty amazing crew. We hit the 2 acre mark, and it's all because of the crew. So yeah, big mahalo to them. It's an incredibly difficult task that is actually really hard to describe. It's really difficult to describe how tough it is.
But for Jackson, getting down in the muck to clear out invasive plants is totally worth it. Invasive plant removal at Imakapaw has allowed insects and other organisms to return to the estuary. And now, Imakapaw is becoming prime real estate for different kinds of shorebirds. Jackson shades his eyes and points to a slender and graceful-looking bird across the pond.
So just on the edge there, the white and black bird with the really long red legs, that's the Io, which is the Hawaiian stilt.
Stilts are water birds, named for their long legs. Seriously, if this bird was a mammal, it'd be a giraffe. The Hawaiian subspecies, the Io, is endangered. A big decline in their preferred habitat is one of the things the Hawaiian stilts are up against. Io like wetlands, with nice open mudflats. And here at Imakapaw, that's exactly the kind of habitat that Jackson and his team are trying to bring back.
And so typically, the last few years, bird counts here, bird surveys, for the stilt, it's been about 5 to 8. So a couple pairs that have called this place home. And just in the last 2 months, we've really seen that number jump up. We were out here one day and we counted, I believe it was 17 birds. And then, you know, the next day we counted 18. And I was thinking, oh, wow, that's pretty amazing. Maybe they're just visiting us. And then the next day we had 21, then 23. And it happened several days in a row, all the way up to 67. And the really neat thing, or the rewarding part of that, is they're staying with us and they're really spending most of their time in the area that we've actually worked to restore. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, and I'm honored just to be able to be a part of it. And I would be okay with helping get dirty in the mud at Imakapaw for the rest of my life.
On the other side of the park, Benson Chong stands on the massive rock structure he works to maintain, the Koloko Fish Pond Wall. It's huge, 30 to 40 feet wide, 6.5 feet high, and stretching 250 yards. It's made up of stones that he and his crew move and stack, one by one, in the traditional way.
800 years ago, we didn't have no stores back then. All we had was, this was our ice box. And this meant something. This is how we live.
Today, the Koloko Fish Pond still means something. The fish pond stands as an example of native Hawaiian ingenuity, of living in close connection with nature. As the master mason for the park, it's Benson's job to maintain this enormous stone wall that shelters the fish pond from the powerful waves just beyond.
The capstones, which is the papale, is for the top, is the long flat stones, nice flat faces.
Nice flat faces that are good for walking or standing on top of the fish pond wall.
The niho stones is the big, round, long stones, which we use for the bottom to help brace the waves. The haka haka is just small fills, medium size, that doesn't have no face, no purpose for the the visual sense, and we just use that to fill in the back.
Determining what's a Papale stone, a Niho stone, or a Hakahaka stone takes some practice. But figuring out where each stone goes and how to orient it, well, that's where we get into the real art and spirit of this kind of traditional architecture.
And, you know, touching the stones is not just a stone, but you kind of, it has meaning. You kind of feel like a purpose for it. And sometimes you're trying to set it, but it won't set. But when you kind of roll it, sometimes the stones kind of set itself. So it kind of speaks for itself when you're actually working on it. You know, some of these stones, they said that even King Kamehameha himself came to help build this wall. So, I mean, stones we're touching is from ancestors 800 years ago. So you kind of feel the energy when you help repair this wall.
The repairs are perpetual because really, all walls against nature are temporary. As strong waves come in from the sea, they inevitably take out sections of wall from time to time.
Here, I mean, people see this and it goes down and the whole front is gone on both sides. And you gotta come back and fix them. And they're like, are you not tired of doing this? Doesn't this make you feel sad that the wave destroyed it? And I tell them, it's Mother Nature, you can't do anything, but if you love your job and you love what you do, I mean, there's nothing that will hold you back. And
while Benson's talking, I can't help but think of all the people I know who might think his job of moving stones by hand is just too hard. And yet here he is talking about how important this work is to him and how gratified he is by his responsibility. Hawaiians have a word for this.
Yeah, this is my kuleana, my responsibility.
It's a responsibility that was passed down to Benson from Master Mason Peter Keka.
Uncle Peter Keka passed away, and when he passed away, my foreman above me was his nephew Jay Keka, and I've learned from Jay and I learned from Uncle Peter. Now it's me passing it on, and as the lead, I mean, not only as a federal employee, but as just a native or someone living here, it feels pretty awesome. So the purpose is just the perpetuate of this culture, of this historical place, the significance, and to pass it on.
Back at Aimakapa, Jackson says he feels this way too. In fact, he used another Hawaiian word, malama, which means to care for or protect.
And what makes Aimakapa even more special and the whole park as a whole is that it's not just the natural environment. Equally so, it's the cultural resources. And because of that, I think people should experience these places and feel the energy here at Aimakapa. It's kind of hard to describe the significance of not just this place, but places like it, especially in the world we live in today. We're surrounded by development and, you know, commercialism, and we know that's not going to stop. So because of that, I think it's even more important to preserve natural places like this, and it should be preserved and maintained forever.
Voices of Science is produced by the National Park Service in cooperation with the Acoustic Atlas at Montana State University. Our staff includes Jennifer Jarrett, David Restivo, Sarah Molina, and me, Brittany Connell. Special thanks to John Joe Keel, Tyler Pakuli Campbell, Benson Chong, and Jackson Letchworth at Koloko Honokohau National Historical Park. To learn more about the park, visit their website at nps.gov/kaho. Find more episodes of Voices of Science at go.nps.gov/vos. Thanks for listening.
Again, that was Brittany Connell with the Voices of Science podcast from the National Park Service. This episode's called Fish Ponds at Koloko Honokohau. For links to the full podcast, visit our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. And, you know, we do have to go, but tomorrow we plan to talk astronomy as Hawaii prepares to host some 3,000 scientists with the Astronomical Society coming up this weekend. We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. You got a New Year's resolution you want to share? Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you want to hear the show again or want to find a past one, find them all on The Conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us all tomorrow for more of The Conversation.